Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the stars and the night sky and learn about a little bit more about the Astronomy Learning Center, known as the UW Space Place. It'll be shuttered soon, and that doesn't mean there aren't opportunities to learn about kind of what lies beyond our world and our solar system. And who better to talk about it than Jim Lattice, former retired as director of the UW Space Place, former manager of the Washburn Observatory, faculty associate in astronomy with the UW-Madison College of Letters and Science. And as we talk with Jim, I hope you will join in. Want to know where to maybe aim your telescope and when? Questions about telescopes, questions about the space place. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Jim Lattice, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's really nice to be back.
So the space place is going to be closing in June. And on going for a while.
Well, yes, certainly by June. We've been sort of ramping things down to, we have to actually be moved out in June.
Okay.
So we've been more or less closed. We had to shut down most of our programming when my colleague and I retired at about the same time, and the university was not, there's a hiring freeze, and they couldn't hire new staff. So the programming more or less stopped, except that we have some energetic student volunteers who've been doing Saturday programs and things like that down there. So we have been trying just in the last few weeks to schedule some, in effect, open house times. Basically, I've been opening the place up and hosting so that people can come in and see our exhibits and talk about the place and have a chance to see it before the before it starts really getting packed up and closed out.
Yeah, I'm thinking about packing up. Do you have there are some historic artifacts and exhibits. I've always loved those. And enjoyed my times there, visiting there for sure.
Yeah, we have stuff going from the earliest days of astronomy on the UW campus, right on up to the things that we built to fly on the Hubble Space Telescope and things like that.
So, what's to become of all of that?
Well, I'm not really. We actually have a pretty good solution for most of it, which I can't actually announce just yet.
Yeah.
But just last week. We got it firmed up. It's going to be in good hands, and it's still going to be available to the people of Wisconsin, I think, for the most part, most of the historic items there. We do have a couple that we're still looking for appropriate homes for, and it's kind of a short fuse sort of at this point. But we're actively working on those. So most of it will have a good home. And I'm certainly pleased about that, but it's taken us the last 6 months to find a suitable home for it. And I think we'll probably announce that pretty soon as everybody is on the same page with that.
What memories will you cherish of the space place? I mean, there's got to be so many.
Right. Yeah, we've been doing that for so many years that it's hard to single out things. I mean, we've had plenty of wonderful events and things there when there's some astronomical event happening. But some of them we used to do just virtually when it was cloudy outside. People could sit in our auditorium and watch something happening on the screen. But the real good stuff was when we had lots of people looking through telescopes at things. So one of my favorites was the transit of Venus in
2008.
Something like that. Yeah, and that was a day when it was kind of partly cloudy here, so we've got telescopes set up with solar filters and things like that out in the parking lot. And there was this enormous suspense because just occasionally the clouds would part a little bit and you'd see the sun and you'd see Venus, the shadow of Venus right there on the surface. And you could just hear a ripple go through the crowd. Oh, it's there. And then people would come over to the telescopes. And then it would, of course, cloud over again. So that happened then over and over again during the course of the event out there. And it was, I mean, you know, it would have been nicer to have a perfectly clear day, but it really highlighted people's interest and enthusiasm, that tension, you know, that that desire to see this remarkable event that we're not going to see again in our lifetimes. So it was things like that, the actual astronomical events that we put on that are my favorites, I think.
Yeah. Did you ever do like telescope production, or I thought you had programs for children that were always fun.
We did, yeah. You know, so we were always looking for ways. Telescopes are actually kind of a tricky problem, but there were two things that worked out particularly well. Years ago, we got a little grant from NASA that allowed us to buy telescope kits that were actually fairly substantial telescopes, respectable telescopes. And we didn't have any good programming for middle and high school students, I didn't feel like. And so we created this program where we partnered with a number of middle schools and high schools, and the NASA money basically supplied the telescope kits so we could buy these telescope kits. They were 3.5-inch Newtonian reflectors, not little handheld things. And then we would build them with the students and the at their school, and then we would help them put on a star party after they had built their telescopes, you know. And one of my favorite moments there is we're at one of these star parties at the school, and I don't remember what it was. It's probably Jupiter, or maybe it's just the moon or something. But some dad looks through there and then looks over at me and says, "My kid built this?" I said, "Yeah, that's isn't that great?" there were lots of things like that where people are learning not just what you see through a telescope, but, you know, the value of having something like that, the motivation of looking at something like that, especially when it's unexpected like that. Kind of like the transit of Venus there, too.
Yeah.
But then we also had, there was also that great program called Galileoscope. And it's a real pity that didn't really take off. But those are little telescopes, but still respectable telescopes. And, SpacePlace was one of the biggest distributors of those while they were still being produced. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of them. We used to have workshops for schools and for the public as well. And they were cheap as telescopes go. You could come in and buy a telescope. We had some grants to provide them to some schools and, again, do like workshops with science classes and things like
that.
My
daughter got one of those.
Did she?
Still in operation.
Still got it? Oh, okay, yeah.
Still in operation. Oh, man. I think you said there's still some opportunities to visit the space place, or are, yeah, there's some events?
Right. There. We have one more. I announced a few couple of weeks ago, and Saturday, what's this? Is this Saturday? Is that the 4th?
Yeah, April 4th.
Yeah. Right. That's the next one that we have scheduled, and then I hope to schedule some other ones later in April. I don't have those. I haven't set any dates yet on those. But, yeah, we'll be down there. We'll just open the doors on Saturday from 11 until 3, I think, were the hours I announced. So people can just drop in, and no particular program, just come and go as they like.
Yeah.
And then we'll, I'll try to schedule a couple more of those as schedules permit.
And people can go to the sites there, UW Space Place?
Yes. You can go to, it's actually, we moved the website. It's it's spaceplace.astro.wisc.edu is now okay. The website. Which is a little different than we used to.
Yeah, spaceplace.astro.wisc.edu.
Wisc.edu.
Yeah. We can put that up on our...
Sure.
We'll put that up on our program notes for today's program, so people, if they want to take a look, they can do.
Sure.
Well, let's... somebody was wondering about the moon...
The moon mission?
The moon mission.
Yeah, the Artemis II.
The Artemis II, and you know a little about that, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, I'm not a space flight expert or anything, but I've certainly been following that. Yeah, that's pretty exciting. So you know, if they get that thing off the ground, and the Artemis 1, the spacecraft which was unmanned, when was that? 2023, a few years ago, There were issues, which is why it's now been 3 years since they relaunched. Yeah. But generally speaking, it worked really well. That was that first launch of that new big rocket that kind of replaces the Saturn, the old Saturn V from the Apollo days. They're going to fly. They're going to go into Earth orbit first for a bunch of testing, but then they're actually going to try out the engines that take them to the moon, and they're going to go out and swing around the moon. I think they call it a free return. You get on such a path that even if your engine fails at that point, the moon slings you around and sends you back to the Earth. So that's a relatively safe
option.
Kind
of a figure eight, it looked like to me.
That's what it looks like, yeah, if you draw it in the right frame of reference. Yeah, it looks like they cross their path and come back. All those things are moving around, so it depends on just how you draw the path. They're going to fly around the moon there, and that'll be the first time human beings have done that since the Apollo program, Apollo 17, whatever that was.
And probably a 72. Precursor to the next one landing?
Well, that's, of course, the plan, yeah. So they have two, this is all about landing, ultimately, on the moon. The big difference here between the Apollo program, when the Saturn V launched astronauts to the moon, they had their lander with them, all in one launch. And so they would land. Everybody remembers that little the lunar module with the legs and the shiny gold foil, and it sits down on the moon. The Artemis is not carrying that. The lander is supposed to go separately and be there, meet the astronauts when they get to the moon. And so there are two companies that have contracts to build lunar landers that go with the Artemis program. One is SpaceX and the other is Blue Horizons, the Jeff Bezos company.
Yeah.
And so I haven't looked into that just lately. At least the SpaceX one has encountered a lot of delays in their development of a lander. So that's a really, really big departure from the Apollo. you get a separate company to contract a completely separate spacecraft that meets you there, and that's on them to get that in line. So that will, until one of those landers is ready to go, there won't be any actual landing on the moon.
Yeah, so the lander. Well, I don't want to get into the. So a lander would land, and then you had to hit the lander.
Well. So they would rendezvous in lunar orbit.
I see. Yeah, was going to say.
Yeah. So they would dock in lunar orbit with the separately launched lunar lander, right? And then they land on the moon, and they then they get back into orbit, lunar orbit again, transfer back to the space cap, the command module of the Artemis, and then and come back. And I guess the lander comes back. I'm not really sure
how that's going to happen, but
I guess it comes. I think the idea is it comes back to Earth and gets refueled there, and then you use it for the next mission. But
it's pretty cool. There's no doubt about that.
it is really cool. Yeah, it's the technology. Some of the technologies have changed so much since the Apollo days that a lot of the stuff should be a lot slicker than we were able to do back then.
Jim Lattice, our guest today, retired as director of the UW Space Place. And, you know, we're going to turn our attention now to some of the planets and the constellation, what's going on in the night sky with him. And you can join in. I hope you do. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look now at the night sky with Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place, former director of the Space Place, retired, former manager of the Washburn Observatory, and he's been a guest How many years have you been on this program, Jim?
Well, not sure. It's been a few years.
It's been 25 years, probably.
Yeah, that's probably about right.
That's probably about right. Kate and Nina has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Kate.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Dr. Lattice.
Morning.
I do have a question. I retired from UW Oshkosh, and while there, I was good friends with Jennifer. And the one thing I really miss about not being connected with the university anymore is having knowledgeable current people give me hints and clues about what's coming up that I should be watching for in the sky. So do you have any recommendations on spring and summer for what I should be watching for in the sky from my backyard?
Sure. Thank you for that. It is something that you have to sort of keep up with. And I'll tell you what I do just in general is I subscribe to Sky and Telescope magazine, and another good one is Astronomy magazine. And either one of those will keep you. They both come out several months ahead. I think I was just reading the May issue of Sky and Telescope. And then there are a few other really good sources. There's something called the Astronomical Calendar by a guy named Guy Ottewell that you can get online. I think you can still buy his printed edition, too. So those are really good information sources. On a shorter term, things like both Sky and Telescope and Astronomy have good websites, and you don't have to be a subscriber to use a lot of those things. There's a couple of really good NASA sites. One of the ones that I check regularly is something called spaceweather.com, which is largely oriented to solar activity. But they note lots of upcoming astronomical events too, one of which that maybe we'll get a chance to talk about here, a possible nova this summer. And, I'm keeping track of that by keeping track of space weather. As far as what's coming up this spring, we actually have, we still have Jupiter in the evening sky, still high up there. And so if you're looking for something to point your telescope at, that's going to be still a good alternative for some time going on into the spring. And then we're also going to have, though, Venus rising higher. Venus is above the horizon just a little bit now. Just after sunset at twilight, but it goes down kind of early, but it's going to be more prominent, as we go into the spring. Those are sort of the planet things to look for. It sort of depends on whether you're thinking of, telescopic observing or just general stargazing, but spring is a really good time for, stargazing. There's a configuration that happens around in the spring, which is that during the early hours of the night, the Milky Way is almost invisible because it ends up being oriented all around the horizon. So you really don't see it. So the sky overhead, if you've got a dark sky, then the sky overhead on a moonless night is especially dark. And there are lots of interesting, certainly constellations, lots of interesting objects up there that are good for your telescope, including just some nice double stars that are really easy to catch. As far as actual events go, there aren't any really good meteor showers until the end of summer, until the Perseids, at least in my trying to winnow them out. There's lots of minor meteor showers that are coming along on and off all the time. But the next good one is really not until August. There are a couple of things you can keep. Going back to space weather, there's a couple of possible bright comets that we might see that might just be visible in the early morning sky. Might be a naked eye visible, those are good options for, say, binoculars if that's kind of your style of astronomical observing rather than a telescope. And binoculars, don't underestimate them. I would just say, make that general comment that they're most people have access to some. They don't have to be special astronomy binoculars, but taking those out on a on a moonless night and exploring some of the star clusters in the springtime sky high overhead, a really good way to make some plans for that is to use a free piece of software called Stellarium that you can download from stellarium.org. And there's also a mobile version of it, too. And so if you were to set it up for one of these spring nights, say, we'll just say it's sort of the end of April, maybe when things are warming up a little bit, and set it for the time that you want to be outside, software like that will highlight interesting objects for you. And then you can use your binoculars, say, to look at some beautiful star clusters and things like that. So that's kind of, in general, that would be my suggestion.
Yeah. There's the, what is it, spring Lyrids meteor shower?
Yeah, right.
We're not going to see much of that.
My recollection is that the moon is not cooperating for that one.
It's about 27% full during that time period.
Yeah, so the evening, 27% full. You mean on, what is the phase of the moon then? What's the date for that peak?
April 14th to April 30th. The peak is April 21st to 22nd.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that's the waning. That's the waning moon. It'll be up in the early morning, in the early morning hours. So that's that. Not a reason you shouldn't go look for Lyrid meteors if you're looking for a meteor shower, but the moon will diminish. The best viewing time is early in the morning, but the pre-dawn hours, and that's when the moon will be interfering there.
I think the most fun time I had watching meteor showers was in Tucson, Arizona, at a friend's place. And Tucson is kind of more of a dark city.
Yeah.
Yeah, they keep their lights off and in the evenings. And we sat in a friend's hot tub. Four of us just sort of lead back and, oh, there's one, and there's one. It was really a lot. It was later. It was in the summer.
Oh, yeah, that would be nice. Right. Tucson is one of the best cities and that have taken control of that kind of the light pollution. And even then, there's still plenty of it out there. But they've been doing that for a long time because of the proximity of the big observatories to them out there. Yeah, one of my favorite the Leonids, when the Leonids were really active about 20 years ago, I had the opportunity to sit on a nice beach in the Caribbean.
Oh,
and they were that was really just really great. Just a lawn chair sitting on the sand and gazing up into the sky. Boy, that was great.
Oh man, Jim Lattice, our guest today. We're talking about the night sky and the planets with him. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Jamie in Algoma. Jamie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I was wondering if your guest knows anything about the big meteor that a lot of people saw and captured last Tuesday, March 24th. I was driving back from Sheboygan to Green Bay about 8:30, and this giant orange ball streaked, seemed like southwest to northeast across the sky, and I guess a lot of people caught it on the Ring doorbells.
So where were you when you saw this?
I was on Highway 43, probably around Manitowoc, driving north.
Wow. I had not heard about that one. That's really interesting. It's not unusual. In fact, there's usually probably a few a day bright, what we often call fireball meteors, and that sounds like a classic case. Most of them don't get observed because they have to come in over a populated area where the sky is not cloudy and things like that. So I hadn't heard about that one, but there has been a little peak of fireballs because we're not very far past the vernal equinox. Well, I shouldn't say because. We don't really know why, but it seems that around the vernal equinox, the frequency of reported fireballs goes up.
Hmm.
There's a peak there, and there's debate in the scientific community about what might be going on there. It doesn't happen at the autumnal equinox 6 months later, so it's not an equinox sort of thing. At least it doesn't seem like it. It may be that the Earth is always in the same part of its orbit at that time of year. And it may be this just by chance that it's near the equinox that several meteor swarms come closest to Earth, maybe cross the plane of Earth's orbit at that place. But that's, I didn't even know about this phenomenon until a few weeks ago. I was reading about it, about this peak, which is then needs an explanation. So it sounds like you saw one of those. It sounds like you saw one of the ones from the vernal equinox fireball peak.
That's pretty cool, Jamie. I wonder if anybody else has seen saw that same thing. It was on March 24th, so there may be others. If you didn't, give a call. Let's hear about it.
Yeah, something like that at night, lots of people see those because they really catch your attention if it's dark and you get this flash in the sky. If the sky's bright, then usually only people who are looking in just the right direction, or now these days the doorbells that are always looking out.
Well, and and a lot of those are pretty darn small,
well,
aren't they?
Relatively speaking, yeah. So, I mean, a fireball meteor is going to have something that, say, you can see in the daytime. That's going to be a pretty substantial piece of rock.
Okay.
You know, something, I don't know, it could be the size of a basketball or something like that. The typical, what we commonly call falling stars, the things that you see typically in a meteor shower or just the sporadics that we see in between meteor showers, those are typically very small particles. But there's a whole lot of energy when they reach the Earth's atmosphere. They're going really fast because it's the collision of the Earth and this particle. And so whatever the resultant velocity between their two orbits are, they come in with a lot of energy. So even a tiny thing, a grain of sand or a small pebble, something, a pea-sized thing would be a bright meteor. Those things burn up, you know, 50 miles over our heads, and we'll still see them. So that's a lot of energy. But yeah, those are tiny particles.
Jim Lattice, our guest today of the UW-Madison Space Place. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234. I paused a second there because I flashed on my yesterday's show. We were interviewing the author of A Short History of the World. And we were talking about the tilt of the Earth. Hmm. And the suspicion was, well, pretty good suspicion, I guess, that a very large asteroid hit the Earth and actually knocked it off its tilt.
Right.
And created the moon.
Right. Yeah, that'd be very early on. That's right. Yeah.
Millions and billions of years ago.
That's the current best accepted theory for the formation of the moon is a massive collision of, really, people talk about two planets. They're more planet-sized than asteroid-sized from that collision. That hypothetical collision, but that seems to match the evidence best, which, by the way, was almost a direct result of the samples that the Apollo missions brought back. The actual chemical analysis of those things ruled out some other theories and brought the collision theory sort of to the into prominence for that. But you can't just keep on invoking hypothetical cosmic collisions ever. I mean, Mars has an axial tilt, roughly the same, within a half degree or so, of the Earth's axial tilt.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen anybody say, well, there has to be a massive collision. There could easily have been that didn't form a massive moon around Mars. But anyway, this one is fairly well accepted and, might have produced the tip in the Earth's axis.
And our seasons.
Oh, of course, right. That's a direct result then, of the seasons, is that we get Mars gets seasons for the same reason. In fact, most of the planets have some sort of substantial tilt that makes not all as much as that, but that makes, or some more that makes for a big difference in the way the solar energy is absorbed on the planet as it orbits around the sun, creates interesting weather patterns, but very important for us, of course.
Kim in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Kim. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for the program. So this winter, we were all the way over on the west coast in Inglewood, and when they launched an Atlas the nine rocket, I was able to videotape it from that distance to see that rocket go up.
It was
amazing.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Those are if you catch one of those at just the right time. What time of day was that?
It was not day. It was night because it's 125 miles away.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the way over on the other side.
Yeah.
But and then also with the meteor, one winter we were out in the country and from horizon to horizon, I saw this meteor going across and trail and just debris particles breaking off as it was coming into the atmosphere. It was something else. It was in January.
Yeah. When those things, the ones I was reading about, so that's interesting. The one near Manitowoc is a new one for me, but there were a couple of those where there were fragments. Meteorite hunters were out right away after these things were sighted, checking for fragments of it. Yeah, it's very common to see them fragmenting. It's a lot harder to find those fragments when they finally get scattered out around on the ground. Those rocket launches have become quite a great sight. And the reason I asked about time of day is that when they happen around twilight, then you get all kinds of interesting solar illumination of the vapor trail and whatever they produce that can look pretty unusual. You've never seen anything like that before because you've never been in the right place when a rocket gets launched and the illumination angle is just right and everything. But that's more and more common to see those things. And then in addition, we have the SpaceX launches that launch these payloads of a few dozen satellites at a time. And then in the succeeding days, again, right around twilight is the best time to catch those. And then you get these string of pearls, they call them. A lot of that stuff happening in space these days produces sights that nobody would ever have seen.
Yeah.
Nobody would ever have seen before.
Kim, thanks for those experiences. Appreciate it very much. Vern and Boyd called to say he believes that if you leave a telescopic camera on overnight for 8 to 12 hours, the sky will appear white. And he wonders if that's the case.
Depends on how you set up your camera, I think. You can certainly, overexpose a camera on skylight if it's. I'm not entirely sure what we're talking about here. If we mean like a cell phone camera or something along that line, that would be one thing. Usually, astronomical cameras don't see the whole sky.
I would think it. I was looking into this a little bit. It could be caused by dew or frost condensing.
Of course that could happen too, and that then picks up scattered light in the environment. That's not then the skylight, but you'd be getting light scattered around from other sources. Yeah, well, that's a good one on me. I don't know without knowing, what camera and just what the circumstances were. It's kind of hard to say.
Jim Lattice, our guest. Questions for him? Give a call. The number 800-642-1234. You could email thetalk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look at the night sky with our guest, Jim Lattice, who's retired from the UW-Madison Space Place. At noon today, we'll talk about the UW-Madison's women's hockey team winning its ninth NCAA national championship. Assistant coach Jackie Crum joins us. And then at 12:30, we'll take a look at jury duty. Have you ever been a part of jury duty? And one more thing, I'm taking a tour around the state before I retire at the end of June, and I'd love to see you. We'll be in Wausau tomorrow night, actually, at the Veninga Theater in Eau Claire. I think that's sold out, but there may be, in fact, I'm sure it is, but there are extra tickets that you might still be able to get. On April 21st, I'll be at the Pablo Center in Green Bay, and on May 12th, I'll be at the Widener Center, and finally in Madison on June 3rd, I'll be at the Barrymore Theater.
Wow.
And I'll be, and all of those will be doing a short interview with Jill, and then we'll take audience questions. It's all free, but we'd like you to secure your seat, and you can register at WPR.org/presents. Looking forward to tomorrow night. We'll see how that goes. And the Barrymore Theater, that's going to be a real trick for me, because it's going to take me a good 4 minutes to get from my home to the Barrymore Theater. I won't be needing to put in any requests for gas. Oh, boy. Yeah, let's go back to stars here. Kevin and Madison, what's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question. I've enjoyed doing nighttime photography, but I've been doing more or less the single shot approach, getting the right lens, the right light, all of those factors together. But I'm curious about what success I would get with methods where they take hundreds and hundreds of shots at the same thing with a very, very high noisy ISO, and then you use digital correction to keep only what's constant across the photos. And with that, I'd just sort of like to take the response offline. Are they doing something similar with more commercial or heavy grade nighttime telescopic lenses doing digital correction or optical correction? I'd like to understand what's going on there.
Okay, sure. Well, let's see. So you're talking about they often call it lucky imaging, where you take lots of images and pick the good ones and stack those up. And process them, and that doesn't take it's more the software that you have to have available to work on those images. You can do it with relatively simple cameras. We did it back in I was just there, but what was that up at Washburn Observatory? There was a shadow transit of Titan, the moon of Saturn. And it was not a great night, but one of the guys who's really good at this from the Madison Astronomical Society took a bunch of images while we were there. And then a week later, after he's worked them over, he sends around this beautiful image. It was better than pretty much any of us saw through the telescope. So there is some expertise on that. I'm a strong advocate of getting involved with the Madison Astronomical Society. If you're anywhere near Madison.
Yeah, he's in Madison.
Okay, so. Yeah. So there are experts there in the club. Their website is madisonastro.org. I think I'm getting that right. And there's an enormous amount of expertise in that group, and they're all happy to share their experience and help people get started in that. So that's a really good. They meet every the second Friday of every month, and they have for about 25 years met at Space Place, but they're shifting their meeting place to Memorial High School. That is going to host them out there for their monthly meetings. So I'm sure that's noted on their website, or will be at a certain point. The last meeting though is going to be in May at Space Place, second Friday in May. Well, and then the second Friday in April is going to come up too. But that would be my suggestion. Aside from there's plenty of good places to learn about that on the internet and things like that. But it's really better to talk to people who have the experience and can evaluate the equipment that you have available and what you can do with it.
And you can probably post a question even on the. And what's the site again? It's Madison.
Madison Astro, all one word, .org.
.org.
Yeah, that's the Madison Astronomical Society. It's a great, great club. They're going to encourage you to join, but the meetings are open to the public, and you're welcome to just. Show up, and I'm often there too. And we all, it's great. You have this, people all come to things from different angles and different expertise and things like that. And clubs like that are great. So since you're in Madison, that would be my recommendation for getting started on that.
Kevin, thank you for calling. I had an email from Gene. Gene emailed to say that lightning on Jupiter will be visible tonight. Train airline.
Okay. They do occasionally spot that. I don't think you can see that in a telescope. I've never seen that in a telescope, but maybe the maybe the Hubble or something.
Maybe the Hubble will be on. Can you look through the Hubble? I mean, we can't go to some screen that shows what the Hubble's seeing.
No, it doesn't work that way. Although anybody can submit an observing proposal. Like you say, I'd love to photograph the lightning on Jupiter. You can make a proposal, and it gets evaluated by a panel of astronomers who rank these things because the time on that is precious. Everybody would love to have time. All the astronomers would love to have time on that. And then they evaluate those things. So the chances of one of us just coming from out here and getting a proposal approved is pretty small, but in theory that's open to the public. But no, there's no live stream check to see what they're looking at.
Too bad. Yeah. Mike in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for the show. It's a good one. The Wolf Moon in January. The Native Americans talked about that. It's the brightest moon in January. It's the first moon, full moon in January. I wanted to get a picture of it, so I stepped out on my stoop here in Madison on the west side, and I saw it. It's really, really bright, and so I took a picture of it with my cell phone. And when I put the cell phone down in front of me, and I looked at it, and there's a green something to green to the right of it. Now the moon was due west, and so I got my phone back up and I enlarged it just a tad bit, and I took another picture, and the green thing had moved to the left, which would be to the south. And I don't know what that was, but it was a green. Somebody told me it was a green orb that pilots see them a fair amount of the time. I don't know if that's true or not.
Huh.
Well, that's a new one. That's a new one for me. Did you zoom back out again and try to take the image again to see whether the image went back to where
it absolutely disappeared?
It had disappeared. It didn't come back. Yeah.
It disappeared. Okay. It was in two locations. I have it on my cell phone. I show it to some friends, and they check the crazy box on me.
Well, I mean, I don't know how. Compared to the image of the moon, how big was it?
The first one, it was about a third of the size. The second picture was half the size.
Huh. So it's maybe like moving away.
Yeah. Nope, you got me. I didn't know that pilots see green orbs all the time either. So I'm not sure what you've got there. My first guess would have been a reflection in the lens because that happens very easily. But if it didn't come back when you recreate it, if you zoom back out again, then it's probably not a reflection. I'm stumped. That sounds interesting.
Maybe somebody else has got a thought on the green orb, Mike, so stay listening. Let's go to Greg and Saner. Greg, hi.
Gentlemen, good day. Hey, I would like your guests' thoughts on the what appears to be increased intensity of solar flares. And if the intense solar flares are capable of an electromagnetic pulse, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
So we are near solar maximum, so there is a regular cycle in the strength and frequency of things like solar flares that has a real rough period of about 11 years or so. And so 5 or so years ago, the sun was pretty quiet. I rarely saw a sunspot, rarely saw a solar flare or anything. But now they're popping off pretty frequently. And there have been a couple of really strong ones just in the last few weeks. And if it follows the normal pattern, then in the next 6 months to a year, it's going to taper off. We should be near the peak and it'll decrease. So there have been some really powerful solar flares that can have really strong effects on the Earth. If you're interested in the subject, there was one in 1850, I'm going to probably get the year wrong here, 57 or 58, but something called the Carrington Event. There's a really good book about that called The Sun King or Sun Kings. I don't remember the author. That had effects on the Earth in the early days of telegraph communications. Before that, such a flare would have had almost no effect on the Earth. But we're even more vulnerable to those sorts of things now, as are all the satellites in orbit. So not exactly an electromagnetic pulse in the way that term is usually used, but it definitely can, it creates magnetic disturbances and electrical disturbances on the Earth. So if those things, if one were to connect just at the right time, it depends on the just how they intersect with the Earth. And they don't always. In fact, most of them, there was a really strong one just the other day, but it was over on the edge of the sun, and so its effects kind of went off in a different direction. Astronomers could see the flare happen, but there nothing to affect the Earth in that case. But whether there's a longer-term increase in the strength of solar flares would be hard to say, because we don't really have a good baseline over very many solar cycles for that kind of thing. What we really have are sunspot counts over a few centuries. But measuring the strength of solar flares is not something that's been done consistently, except maybe in the past, I don't know, the past few solar cycles. So long-term trends are harder to
come by,
establish.
Greg, thank you. Michael emailed to say, one summer as a child, he saw the northern sky turned orange in the early evening. This was near Chicago. And when he returned home, the evening news said it was due to a rare astronomical event. And now he can't remember what the event was called.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's if it was an most people would not call say auroras like the aurora borealis, the northern lights, an astronomical event, at least not these days, although they are connected to solar activity and solar flares. If it wasn't a strong aurora, then I don't know what it might have been. We'd have to dig into some newspaper reports and try to see what that might have been.
In the last minute or so, the blaze star explosion is expected soon.
Yeah. We've been saying that since 2024. this is a fascinating thing. This is what they call a recurrent nova. This star explodes. It's really two stars. It's a star system where one star dumps matter onto its companion, and when enough of that accumulates, the companion explodes all of that gas. It doesn't destroy the star, but there's an outburst. It gets many thousands of times brighter than it is right now, which is pretty dim. But it brightens it up enough that we can see it by eye. So this has been observed roughly every 80 years for the past two or three cycles.
Yeah.
How do you predict another one? The astronomers have had various models for how this works and what that means for when it's going to pop off the next time. And the models predicting 2024 were wrong, it turns out. And the models predicting 2025 were wrong. So now there's another one, though, predicting June this year. So one of these models is going to be right. And so
I predict if it doesn't happen this year in June, it'll happen next year in June.
That's right.
That's the Mueller prediction.
We'll get you on record there so you can claim that. Yeah. But something to watch for. Spaceweather.com is a good place to keep checking for that. But you have to keep checking because when it happens, the sky brightens up the star brightens up quite nicely. It's in the nice summer sky in the constellation Corona Borealis. It brightens up to second magnitude or so, which is about the brightness of the North Star. So a prominent, not the brightest, but a prominent star. But it probably will only last a couple of days. So you need to know that it's happened and then get out there that night to get a look at it. And then once it's gone by, it'll be another 80-odd years until
we won't be around for that one.
Yeah. Enjoy it this time. Yeah.
Boy. And speaking of enjoying, I always enjoy talking with you, Jim. Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure, Larry.
Jim Lattice, former director, retired as director of the UW Space Place. It's been great to talk with him about the Space Place and about the night sky, and hopefully we can do that again with him down the road. Coming up, we're going to talk with Jackie Crum, the assistant coach of the UW-Madison's National Championship Hockey Team. That next, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.